All right, welcome to Inside Independent Publishing with IBPA. I'm your host, Christopher Locke. I'm also the IBPA Director of Membership and Member Services. I'm going to do one very quick announcement, everyone. We have on IBPA's Publishing Universities coming up on April 25th through 27th. It's an incredible conference for independent publishers and author publishers. And we very much appreciate you for listening to this podcast. So we're going to give you a 15% discount code somewhere within the podcast. So make sure to listen to the whole thing. You'll get that. And then go to publishinguniversity.org and you can get all the conference details. All right. So there is a huge market for books outside of the United States. So how can U.S. publishers break into the international market? And how do publishers know which markets are a good fit for their titles? Co-founder and managing editor of Red Hen Press, Dr. Kate Gale, joins the podcast today to share details about how her publishing company succeeded at international sales, as well as the challenges and opportunities publishers face based on the city where they set up their business. We're also going to discuss tips on book distribution, so much more. Hello, Dr. Gale. How are you?
Very good. So I'm actually joining you from Chapman University, where I teach publishing. And interestingly, this bit about foreign rights is part of what my students here are most excited about. Yeah. I don't know if it's because they want to travel or they're just intrigued by the fact that that in foreign countries or just in other countries, there's so much interest in books and in stories. When I come back from the Frankfurt Book Fair, the Sharjah Book Fair, and the Guadalajara Book Fair, they're always interested to hear those stories. So I'll tell you one story. I went to the Beijing Book Fair right before the pandemic, and I had a few stories that I thought they would be excited about. And this young woman said, "I've looked at something in your back catalog that we would really like to buy." And usually, you know, you tend to be selling more frontlist titles. Mm. Once in a while, a backlist title, but mostly frontlist titles. And so I said, "Well, okay. So what was it you're interested in?" And she said, "A book called Meaning of Names." Now, Meaning of Names was one of our better sellers. It had what you call a long tail. And that a long tail means that, like, the frontlist, you know, sells for, you know, for an indie book, that means 4 to 6 months. For a big five press, that might mean more like 12 weeks. But we kind of tend to keep pushing the book for 4 to 6 months. But in this case, the long tail meant that this author continued to go out and do events for a couple of years. And she's a Nebraska author, so she has kept doing events in the Midwest. And so so this was a book that had continued to sell well, and it was about the first pandemic, maybe not the very first, maybe the Black Plague might have been one of the earlier ones, but in this case, the first one that we think of in this country, which was the big flu. And it was also about that period of history. And so she said she was very excited about that, and she wanted to buy that book. I thought it was kind of an interesting choice. It's a very Midwest novel and, you know, for a Chinese publisher. But she said, you know, "I think there's going to be another pandemic. It might even start in China." She almost said jokingly. And I said, "Oh, well, okay." So they bought the rights to that book and they published it in China. And actually, because of the pandemic, I have not gotten to go back to the Beijing Book Fair. But if I do, I want to find that 22-year-old woman and ask her what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I know, right? That's amazing. Well, that's what we want to talk about because so Red Hen Press has been around for 30 years and you all have had success in the international market. So I kind of want to go back to initially, what was it initially that made you go, okay, I want to break into that market? And then also, how did you even start?
So there's another indie press that I really admired, Akashic Press, and Johnny Temple, you know, he's an international rock star. So, I mean, I think it came naturally to him to want to go to rights fairs. But he was going to Frankfurt and, I was just like, if Johnny can do it, I can do it. But I have to say the first time I was setting up myself to go to Germany, because Frankfurt is the biggest one, and I'm setting up meetings there. There's like 40 meetings I'm going to go to with people I don't know. The Frankfurt Book Fair is extremely vast. So often the meetings are like 30-minute meetings, and you'll have like 10 of them a day. And often you're racing from one meeting to the next, from like hall six to hall four. And there's like, you know, you have a 10-15 minute meeting, and it is like a 10 minute run to the next meeting. And I didn't know any of these people. So you're meeting the Japanese, the Italians, the French, the Dutch. And I just thought, you know, that it was just completely overwhelming. And actually, I've been going since like 2010. And last year is the first year I went with somebody else. So I've done Frankfurt by myself all this time. And so I really, based on the fact that Akashic was doing it, I figured if they can do it, I can do it. But it was quite overwhelming at first. The number of meetings and just the number of people. Frankfurt attracts like 275,000 people. So it's like a city descends on the city. And London felt more manageable at like 25,000 people. I've only been to Bologna once. Guadalajara is quite a bit more manageable, although you'll often encounter people who will want to have the whole meeting in Spanish. And so I am there asking them, despacio, despacio, you know, please speak a little more slowly because my Spanish is somewhat limited, as in quite a bit limited. So, I mean, I can understand them as long as they're taking it easy on it, the Spanish. So it felt quite overwhelming at first. But after a while, what I learned was to ask questions. You know, what are the Italians into this year? What are the French into this year? What are the Japanese excited about? And then I would come out with the books we had on our list that might fulfill those expectations. So in the beginning, I think like a lot of Americans, I tended to just talk too much. And I learned to be a much better listener. And then I think, you know, I ended up with some surprises. We had this book called Pigs, which was this very much Calvino-esque kind of novel that we ended up selling to the Turks. You know, we had this book called Eat Less Water with all these Mexican recipes that we sold to the Italians. And so we've had some surprises because we listened to what people seem to be excited about. And then just, I would just kind of follow my gut.
When you go over there, you don't have a booth over there. You go, they have the booth, and then you set up meetings with them, and you're just kind of free floating to and setting up these meetings, right?
So in Frankfurt, I am part of the international booth. So there is a quote American booth that I'm there, and Akashic is part of that booth as well. And so that does help. So I can have some meetings there, but a lot of times they'll want me to come to their booth. So I am kind of racing around. And I also have a place at Guadalajara. I have a table. And in London, I'm racing around. And in Sharjah, I have a table.
And then when you set up the meetings, how are you setting those up? Like, how do you even know how to connect with these publishers at these various events?
So, you know, there is a list of who's coming. And so I obviously try to identify publishers who are publishing the kind of work that we are publishing. So if they only do, you know, high fantasy, or if they only do children's books, or if they only do, you know, children cookbooks or something, obviously I wouldn't be meeting with them. We tend to publish, you know, upmarket fiction, a little bit of detective and mystery, a lot of literary fiction. And so that's the kind of publisher that I tend to be meeting with.
Okay. Because so, you know, obviously you physically going, the cost of the flight, the cost of the, you know, the getting into the conference, all that can be a little costly. I can say IBPA does have a program called the IBPA Book Frankfurt Book Fair Program. We also have one for the Bologna Book Fair, but there are obviously many others that you're going to. So I wanted to see about, you know, like when you're then doing these meetings, you're selling the rights to them. Like when you're mm-hmm. meeting with them, you're the, I guess, American publisher, but then you meet with them and then they're going to publish the book in that country. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about how that whole process works?
So there are countries, let's start with, by the way, that you are aware going into it are going to have less money You know, and that's one of the things I realized. I think Frankfurt number one, my first Frankfurt, I started making notes that the Germans, the Dutch, the Scandinavian countries had more revenue than, say, the Greeks would have. And by the time I got to Sharjah, I realized that the Syrians and the Egyptians would be spending much less. And in fact, that's part of the reason that most American publishers don't go to Sharjah. There might be other reasons as well. It's a largely Arabic conference, and so there might be other reasons. But also, there is not a whole lot of money being spent, I think, at Sharjah Book Fair. So there's that consideration: how much money you can actually ask for. So you go in with that, and you also though have to think about what kind of stories everybody is looking for and kind of, what they might be excited about. Sorry, can you go back to your question again?
Yeah, no worries. So I'm interested in, when you go there and you're trying to sell, you know, I'm trying to help the people listening in terms of understanding, like, you know, you're selling the rights for them to publish the book in their country. Like, they're an actual publisher, uh-huh, and they'll publish the book versus like you somehow selling the book into that country. If they're an actual publisher you're selling the rights, right, to, right?
So, yeah. So one of the ways of thinking about it is, like, you know, we were going to talk later about the fact that, you know, I have a book coming out. And so the book that I have coming out, the quote audiobook rights have just sold, right? And so I'm presumably at some point going to get, quote, a check for the audiobook rights. That's it. I get one check for the audiobook rights. And then that audiobook company gets to sell the, do whatever they want to with the audiobook rights. Now, if that audiobook really took off and became a smash hit and they sold 100,000 copies of the audiobook rights, they just lucked out. Right. Mm. That's good for them. But I'm still going to be paid the amount that the contract said, because that's how much that contract said, right? Mm-hmm. So there is a contract that says the publisher gets this much, Kate gets this much, end of story. The same thing is true for Eat Less Water, which we sold to the Italians. I can't remember how much it was, but let's say it was $3,000. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's how much it's sold for. If it becomes a huge hit in Italy, then good for that publisher. They bought the rights to publish it in Italy. Mm-hmm. It isn't like, sometimes people will be like, oh, isn't she going to get more royalties? No, it's done. Mm-hmm. We've sold the rights, just like the audiobook rights got sold. So the way you think about it as a publisher is sources of revenue we have for us, the publisher, and for the writer are, one, the North American sales. That's number one, obviously. However many books we sell in the United States. Secondary source is obviously the ebook sales, right? Third is the audiobook sales. So we try to sell the audiobook rights, and that could be a small chunk of change. You might sell them for $10,000 to an audiobook company, $5,000 to the publisher, $5,000 to the author. Another thing is whatever I can sell it for to the foreign rights. So if I sell $8,000 worth of rights or $10,000 worth of rights or, you know, $20,000, I'm splitting that out with the author. They get half of it. Publisher keeps half of it. That's it. And then, of course, you know, then there's film rights beyond that. But each of these things generally are getting split. Now, if there's an agent involved, the agent is taking 15%. Most of our prose does come from agents. And I know that there are people that don't want to have an agent because they don't want the agent taking 15%. Mm. And I can see both sides of this, but let me say, as someone who does have an agent, that you can keep saying, I don't want to have an agent. But I think that, that if you don't have an agent, often you're arguing about 15% of nothing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? If you had an agent, I think generally you would have a bigger sale possible. And so I guess, I mean, having the wrong agent is kind of like having the wrong spouse, you know, it would suck. But having the right, you know, having the right agent means that you have a chance of a bigger sale, whether it's a film sale, even someone that gets published with Red Hen, that agent is still helping them negotiate a good deal with us. And it still means that if that book became a movie or something bigger happened with it, that agent's going to help them negotiate that. Yeah. So I have to say, I still think that agents, the right agent, can be helpful. And the right agent is not going to say to you, oh, don't go with Red Hen or Grey Wolf or Tin House because they're not big enough. Let's wait around another 10 years and see if we can get Viking Penguin. They're not. If they think that the right indie press is going to be good for your book, they're going to say, let's go. Yeah. This editor is enthusiastic. Let's jump in with both feet.
Hello, everyone. I'm just cutting into the interview real quick because, as promised, we have a special discount to IBPA Publishing University just for you podcast listeners. So the conference is on April 25th through 27th in Denver, Colorado. You're going to get a 15% registration discount, 15%. Go to publishinguniversity.org and use the promo code IBPA Podcast 2024. Again, that's all one word, IBPA Podcast 2024. And as an added bonus, if you're not already a member of IBPA, you're going to register for the conference and you're going to get a free membership to IBPA. So we hope you take advantage of all the benefits. If you do, we will also be excited to see you at the conference. Now back to the show with Dr. Kate Gale. I did want to ask about, you know, the traditional distribution, because that is something that a lot of publishers are, you know, trying to acquire. When during your journey with Red Hen Press, when did you all land traditional distribution where now you have a sales team going out, you know, selling your books to bookstores, retailers, and all that? How did that come to be?
So when I was just at AWP in Kansas City, we were talking a bit about distribution at one of the meetings. And I said that when I'm talking about publishing to my class at Chapman, I say there's three things you need to start a publishing company that you can't buy: distribution, distribution, and distribution. Mm-hmm. And so, yes. So when we got started, I think we were like a year or two in of doing our own distribution, which basically Amazon actually started in 94, the same year Red Hen started, but it didn't really have much of the heft it does now. So we were basically just, you know, pretty much going around and getting our books into bookstores, which is pretty much what Green Integer does. They just have somebody that just gets their books into local bookstores in Los Angeles. And so that's kind of what we were doing in the beginning. Then we were with SPD for a while. And SPD is, I'm sure you're aware of it, Small Press Distribution in Berkeley. Yeah. We were with them briefly. And then, of course, we wanted to have sales team. And so we went to the University of Chicago. And that's a pretty normal trajectory. Mm. You're a micropress. You're publishing two or three books a year. You might be kind of trying to do it on your own. Now what micropresses do is they usually do Ingram Spark printing so that if the author does an author event at a bookstore, they can order them. And Ingram will supply them, because that's obviously what Ingram does, is supply to bookstores. But mostly their books are available on Amazon. You know, maybe 95% of their sales are through Amazon. They're being printed with Lightning, whatever it is. They're all sort of mostly on Amazon, except for a few events that they do. And so we were basically at that micro press model before there were all the whistles and bells that there are now. Then we went to the university model, which again is a fairly common trajectory, that you go to the university model until you hit like 100,000 in sales, somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000. You want to have usually a larger sales team. And then the tendency is to go to, you know, to kind of search around. And, you know, this was really when Ingram was aggregating. And so Ingram has Two Rivers Consortium and PGW at this point. And we're with PGW, which has like 55 salespeople. they're the distributor for the Elena Ferrante books. They're on the West Coast. We just have to fly up to Berkeley. It's pretty sweet. Myself and my marketing director both have friends up there, so we have places to stay, and it's a pretty easy thing. We're up there 4 times a year for that, for our pre-sales meetings and our sales meetings. And it's worked out really well. What's beyond that is corporate distribution, and that's what Grey Wolf has. So Grey Wolf is with Macmillan. Mm-hmm. Akashic is now with Norton. So that's corporate. And whether we'll ever do that, I mean, I don't know. What I know is that our marketing director is completely happy with PGW and with the services they provide and with their sales team and with everything they're doing for us. So that's not even a consideration.
And landing PGW, you had to have a certain volume of books that you were selling at that point. And then did you fill out an application? Like what was the process of actually getting them to accept you all as, on their, client list?
So there was a meeting. Our publisher at the time, I'm the publisher and CEO now, but our publisher at the time and our marketing director met with them and went over all the figures and went over, where we wanted to be. And they accepted us. And obviously they offered a contract. So they had to go over the contract and compare it with the contract that we had with Chicago. And then we also had to agree to ship 60,000 books from Chicago to Nashville. There was some work involved, but I know that our marketing director is extremely happy with what PGW has done for us.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that you all are located in Los Angeles, and this is something we talked about that I think is really interesting. When someone's starting out an indie publishing company, they may not put as much thought into their location, like physical location, because they might just live in that city, right? Like we all kind of had jobs and we just, but we're like, I've got a dream. I'm starting an indie publishing company. So I was interested in, for you, when you and I were speaking before, it sounded like Los Angeles, in hindsight, may not have been like the best set up city to succeed as an indie publisher. I mean, you've clearly done very well. So can you talk about that? Like, what were like some of those initial challenges that made you kind of realize, oh, wow, starting out here, it may have been easier in like New York City or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I was at a meeting yesterday about that was arts leaders in the city of Los Angeles. And we were all from very small organizations to much larger organizations like Japanese American Museum. And a number of the funders were there, from the Getty to the Amundsen. And at one point I brought up in the group that I was in that a number had floated around that LA was 26th in the nation in arts giving. And I was asking if that could be verified. And no one really was sure where exactly that had come from or whether it was now true. But someone did bring up that California as a state gives less to the arts than, wait for it, Florida.
Interesting.
And so that was a little painful to hear. I don't want to be behind Florida in any way, except that Florida has more headlines that say man does such and such, I think that it didn't dawn on me when we were starting the press. First of all, it didn't dawn on me that we were going to be a nonprofit and that was going to mean that we were going to need the amount of arts giving. And so, if you were doing the analysis of where you're going to start something, one of the conditions would have been, is this a good arts giving city? And LA isn't. LA is not a city that supports the arts. And particularly, it's not a city that supports the literary arts. The other thing I would say, though, is if I were advising someone who was going to start something like Red Hen in the future, I would say someone on the team should have come from money, because when I look at other organizations in LA that have done well, it's because someone on their team came from money. Because I think that people with money like to give to other people who come from money. And so I think that part of the reason it's been a bit of a slog for us is that, you know, my husband and I both didn't come from money, and we haven't really acquired any members of the team who came from money, because I think people tend to feel more comfortable with people like themselves, you know. And so, so I think that we're a tough scramble kind of team at Red Hen. And so, so it's, you know, it's been a bit of a scramble, you know, to raise money. First of all, LA is just not a good city for it. And New York would have been better. Minneapolis would have been better. San Francisco would have been way better.
Chicago?
I think Chicago would have been better, and possibly even Portland and Seattle. I mean, I think Seattle, you know, has a lot of tech money. So we didn't think any of that through, but now that we are here in Los Angeles, it also feels like, you know, we're making a difference in a city that maybe needs a literary presence. So now it is what it is, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I just thought that was an interesting concept that, you know, I think people don't think as much about, because again, they just live in a location and they have this passion, but they may not be setting themselves up for success, you know, once they really start, you know, growing. I did want to ask also about just growth in terms of like employees and such. I mean, at some point, there's this push and pull where you, a lot of times, you know, it's normally just one person who's the founder and or maybe two people. So how was that for you when you were able to finally start hiring employees? How did you first start with contractors and then make them full-time employees? What were some of the first positions that you were like, okay, this is who I need first, so that, you know, other people out there that are still growing can learn from maybe your successes or things you might have, you know, wish you had done differently?
Well, so my husband and I were not married when we started the press. We were friends, and then we started dating, and then we got married so we could fight about the press more easily. but we started with the skill sets that we had. So I was finishing a PhD in English, so I figured I could do the editing, and he came with a lot of design skill. So he was doing the layouts of the books. And so what we needed was someone to help with marketing and publicity. And so we filled in those skills, and then eventually, you know, we needed someone to help with social media. It wasn't really a skill we had. Eventually we needed someone to help with graphic design. And so I think that tendency is to start with, if you're a founder, you have whatever skills you have and you start filling in around that. I think like a lot of founders, Mark worked for free for, I think, a year and then started being paid a small amount and then more. I volunteered for Red Hen for 25 years.
Oh, my gosh.
I only started being paid by Red Hen in 2017. And so I think that when they talk about founder burnout, it is very easy to get burnt out as a founder, because you feel like the board doesn't really understand what I put into this or whatever, because you have put in a lot of free labor. I certainly feel that I have put in a lot of free labor here. But I really am hoping that the next generation are all... that I can build to a place where the next generation are all consistently and well paid. And so, you know, there's going to be a massive difference between what second generation Red Hen is and what first generation Red Hen is. So we built on marketing and publicity and social media, and then these graphic design skills and, you know, skills that we didn't have. And because we're in Los Angeles, we've always had like at least 2/3 of the the office has been LGBT and BIPOC. We feel very fortunate that that's just who's come and wanted to work with us. And so we've always had a very diverse staff who bring their very diverse ideas to us, which has been fantastic.
Yeah. And so then you and your husband, I guess you all were doing day jobs. Like you were doing Red Hen in addition to other jobs.
So he, let's see, we started the press in 94. He quit his job in 2000. And so he's been full-time at Red Hen since then. I was doing day job until 2017.
Wow.
So I was doing full-time at a university and then full-time at Red Hen until 2017.
Wow. Okay. And so, and you're still, you said, because you're at Chapman right now, so you're still, you still have classes that you're teaching about publishing.
Yeah. So basically I still, to make everything come together, I still need some side hustle.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Wow. Well, I think it's something important that people don't understand as much, you know, it is passion and it is, you know, like, I mean, you all have been quite successful, but you're still out there, like you said, hustling and still have other, you know, sources of income. You know, I think we all wish that our like passion were the main job, but you know, book publishing is not the film industry in terms of the amount of money that, you know, the people doing it are making. So, you know, kudos to you for the success you've had, but for sticking with, you know, doing, I mean, I can only imagine when you sleep, with all the various things you're probably having to juggle. So, and you also have a book that's coming out on April 23rd under a neon sun. Can you tell us are you publishing this through your press or doing it elsewhere? How did that come to be?
So it's being published through a book called Three Rooms Press that's in New York. It's an indie press. And so actually my husband ran into them at some conference that he was at something that he was at. And he was telling them about this book I had written and they're like, oh, she should send it to us. And they got very excited about it. And it was a pandemic novel. I mean, it is very much a pandemic novel, but it's also a novel, you know, I wrote during the pandemic. I guess I had a little time on my hands. But it was so, when I was in college, I'll give you this sort of 60 second version of what got me excited about writing this. So I had grown up in a cult. And when I left the cult, I started college at this African-American college in Virginia. And it was quite exciting and everything. And then eventually I moved to Arizona. But because I didn't have any parents or anything, I was often sort of, you know, in and out of between apartments, living in my car for a little bit, and then I would finally save up enough for first and second month would always seem like to me a vast amount of money, and get back into an apartment again and like that. And so at the point that I got to California and got into graduate school and started teaching community college students, I realized that there's a lot of community college students in California who were situated in the same kind of way. Who would be, you know, sleeping in their cars and going to college. And so in my book, I have a community college student who is going to Pierce College, which is quite near me, and is living in her car, and then the pandemic hits. And The Guardian and the LA Times just both did articles about the thousands of community college students in California that live in their cars. And I'd love to see California at least have safe parking lots that were kind of lit up and maybe kept somebody who was in security, kept an eye on these students so that you knew you could park somewhere. Because obviously it's dangerous. It's much more dangerous now than it was for me. I didn't know anybody else that was sleeping in their car. I do not think there was thousands of people in Arizona at all sleeping in their cars. So I think that it's much more dangerous now. And so I would love for California to do that. And I feel like it would then be a step towards the state wanting to then provide some sort of housing, even if it were tiny houses or something, for these students. if you look out at, you know, hundreds of girls and boys sleeping in their cars, you'd want to do something about it, you know?
Absolutely, sure.
So my girl, you know, is sleeping in her car, and then the pandemic hits. She has, you know, it was one thing when she could go on campus and use the computers and get a shower and then go to her babysitting jobs, but now she can't. And so you can imagine things go wrong for her. And so things unravel. And so I have her kind of trying to keep her life together during the pandemic. And I sort of wanted it to be sort of the opposite of like a Lucy by the Sea book where, you know, rich people leave New York and just have to, they have to live in Maine and then they have sex there and so on. I wanted people to actually die and you know, stuff to go wrong. But I think it's also, it kind of comes together. There is a, you know, the George Floyd event happens in the novel because I felt like you can't write a pandemic novel without that happening. We'll see how it goes. It was definitely very interesting to write and very difficult at times. And brought back some odd memories for me. But I also hope that it makes a difference because I would like this to be a bigger subject of discussion in California. So
yeah. No. Well, congratulations. It's certainly sounds like a important topic that people should be learning about, but that they get to learn about in an entertaining way as well. So congrats on that, and also congrats on the success of Red Hand Press. Like you mentioned, your AWP conference, I was there as well, and you all were always had people at your booth, and it was very popular. So, just congrats. And thanks for sharing all of your, details about foreign rights and then, the cities people can set up in and all that. I really appreciate that. Make sure everybody who's listening and watching, you want to check out redhen.org. Again, that's redhen.org, the Red Hen Press website. Check out Under a Neon Sun, comes out April 23rd from Dr. Kate Gale. And also, we hope that you check out IBPA, become a member. We have tons of benefits for independent publishers and author publishers. Just visit IBPA-online.org. Also, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Drops every last Thursday of every month. Also, it's on YouTube. You can check it out there. Dr. Gale, thank you so much. Really appreciate all this information. It's certainly helpful for publishers to learn from other publishers. And, you've had some great success. So hopefully others can have all the success you've had as well. And I hope many more continued years of success.
Thank you so much for having me on.